Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on today's episode, we look at Hugo Ekitike's move to Liverpool. What do we think of the player? What do we think of the plan? And how good could he be for the Reds? Then we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we look at Newcastle's search for a striker. What do we think is going to happen with Alexander Isak? And how can Newcastle go about reinforcing their attack? And then we bring you the name of the year bracket. That's in anything but football. And that's all this week on Unseen Incidents. Ooh, just about made it through that intro. I was quite close to fucking it two or three times there, Pete.
Kind of started speaking like Yoda at the end in like awkwardly structured sentences.
Yeah, where I was just like...
Name of the year we will discuss.
Don't know how to get to the thing. We'll just start with the noun. So like, name of the year is coming up later
discuss
on.
Discuss we will like, but football anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How are you, Pete?
I'm good. Happy to be here. I must say that this is one of the instances where I do somewhat regret that this isn't a visual podcast as well as audio, because the outfit that you've bowled into this recording with is quite spicy. I'm looking at a light blue shirt. Okay, it's actually a popover, but in true Patrick Van Straten style, it is very, very plunging. We've got the pasty skin accented with the dark chest hair.
I'm not actually pasty at the moment. I'm pretty tanned at the moment.
Yeah, but globally pasty.
Okay, sure. Yeah, fair enough.
And topped off with just a little pop of bling in the thin necklace that I assume you've got repaired. Is that the one that you broke?
Bro, I've had it repaired like twice. I kept fucking... Like this last time, I was just like, can you just do anything to... Can you check it? And so he went through like kind of tugging each like link just... He was like, I think you've broken most of the weak links now. So I was like, great. Okay. Well, that's the main thing. But every now and then one of my children gets a hold of it and I sort of have to like stop them breaking it.
Yeah. But Bonnie's in a really, really grabby phase at the minute. Anything in front of her face. She's just, well, it's a real...
Glasses,
hair, mustache, lips, noses. and yeah, you know, for particularly in the nose region, I've got quite a prominent one. So there's real... So you can really get a good few fingers up at each nostril.
But also when you wear your glasses and your nose and moustache, like all kind of, it all looks like they're attached, they're plastic and they're attached to the glasses. Like... So she's like, if I pull the glasses off, the nose and the moustache will come with it.
It's like one of those really bad disguises that you get in like a joke shop. The moustache, the big nose and the like thick glasses. Yeah. It's just my face.
But maybe, but obviously she's suspicious. Obviously she's got question marks around that.
Yeah. I mean, and rightfully so. I am her second favorite person in the world, but it is a distant second.
Sure, understood.
I'm unsure if I didn't have said moustache and questionable features, whether I'd be higher on that list, whether it would be the gap would be closer between me and Jess.
Having a nice high contrast face is good for a baby, right? Like they like it.
Yeah.
Like I think like having a beard I think really helped me in the early days. One, because they both like to pull it. But also I think they were like, "Oh okay, I see what this face looks like." Yeah. It's like dark bit up here, dark bit down there, pink bit in the middle.
Yeah, which is precisely what I just described. 5 minutes ago, 3 minutes ago. Her attention definitely goes from the mustache to the hair. Especially when the hair like flops about a bit if it's not done. Like those are her two.
Oh, so she absolutely clowns you when your hair looks shit.
Well, she just stares at it.
I remember Goldie used to do this with Emma. Like when Emma, you know, when Emma had a towel wrapped around her head after washing her hair, Goldie would just look at her and then like look up at it in this really bitchy way that was amazing. And sometimes if you're wearing a new hat, she'll just stare at it the entire time you're talking to her, which honestly, humbling. It's like it's not great for the self-confidence, I will say, but it is quite funny and good practice for later in life.
Yeah. And also a good litmus test of, you know, does this fit work? Does this hairstyle, haircut work?
She doesn't know. She's got no idea, ma'am.
Hey, Emma or Goldie?
Goldie. She's got no clue. She doesn't know a thing. At the moment, she just gets dressed. She gets dressed in such a way as to not annoy us when her clothes get ruined at nursery. Because she's really in the phase where everything gets ruined at nursery.
Right, okay.
They use washable paint. It's not washable. She scoots around on the floor. Floor's dirty. Rips holes in her trousers. Okay. So there's just no point putting her in anything nice at nursery at the moment. She's just going to fucking tear it apart. But she's a little cave woman. Yeah, cave baby.
Kit.
She looks just like me right now as well. Okay. Shall we get into it? Because Liverpool basically, like this whole story happened in such a short period of time. It was like Newcastle were linked with Hugo Ekitike. Then Liverpool were linked with Alexander Isak. Then Newcastle supposedly might have rejected a bid of like 120 for Isak. Liverpool, meanwhile, were like, if you don't sell us Isak, we're going to go in and get Ekitike. Ekitike was like, I only want to go to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And like 48 hours later, Ekitike to Liverpool was done. And so I believe he's already there. I believe he's already like with the squad. I think it's like 69 mil guaranteed plus another 10 mil in add-ons. So just over 90 million euros. So it's a big old fee for a 23-year-old. Liverpool's spending is, I mean, you've got to imagine it's done, but it kind of still feels like they need to send it back to me. But Pete, what's your initial take on all this, on this whole situation?
The move in isolation, Ekitike to Liverpool, I do generally have a lot of time for. It's a player that we've spoken about a bit before, and he's one of the kind of very exciting youngsters moving in this window. And when you look at the team he's coming into, a team that obviously won the Premier League last year, a team that has heavily invested this summer, close to £300 million as it stands. They've got Wirtz for, you know, a fee that could be £116 million-ish. Frimpong came in for £30 million. Kerkeres, £40 million. Mamardashvili, 25 plus a bit. So they have gone out and really, really spent big, particularly looking at Ekitike, Wirtz and Frimpong as like real needle movers for this squad going forward in the next season. So while I wanted Isak, I don't mind that they didn't get him, because I think it takes, like, teams like United historically have gotten too fixated on a player and just watched the price go up and up and up and still gone for it. And it's been an overpayment. Mm. I think Newcastle said, we want Isak. They might have offered, like you say, maybe 120 mil. I've seen reports that are like have indicated that Newcastle valued him as high as 150 mil. Liverpool having the kind of intelligence to say, you know what, that's X percent above what we're willing to pay, and we're not going to pay that. We're just going to go get somebody we think that we can do, who can do as good or close to as good a job, or at least a proportionally good enough job based on how much we're going to spend on him. So I think it's really, really smart. Ekitike is more of a gamble in the sense of being unknown. He is younger, so you would say that he could have a higher ceiling. He's yet to hit his peak. But in saying that, if you can't get Isak, Ekitike kind of feels like when your mum says, we've got Isak at home. In that, he does a lot of things Isak does, not to the same level. And there are unknowns about Ekitike. He still has a lot to develop. But if you're going to spend 80 mil on Ekitike versus 150 on Isak, I'm kind of inclined to go with Ekitike, because there is enough there to think that he's a really, really good player. You're getting him at a good age. You will get all of his peak years. And the team around him are really, really good, really dominant, really creative. And it feels like if Ekitike is going to thrive in a system, Liverpool is one of the teams that can really help him kind of maximise or realise his potential. Mm-hmm. And while Isak would be great, because he has proven, at Premier League level, he's got over 20 goals in two consecutive Premier League seasons. Like, it's really, truly top goal-scoring talent. For the price that they were being quoted, I kind of feel that Ekitike, for me, is a more sensible option and gives them longer to work with him. Because they've also still got players like Nunez. We don't know what's going to happen with him, but they have other players there that Ekitike doesn't necessarily, at the minute, this could change in the next few weeks, but at the minute he doesn't need to be fully relied on for all of their goals. Isak would have come in and been like, you are going to score us like 25 plus league goals this season, we imagine. Ekitike is probably a little bit back on that, but if he comes in and scores like in the teens in his first season as a 23-year-old, plus supplemented with hopefully Salah's still decent output, probably, obviously I would imagine less than last season, because last season was otherworldly, but still should be good. Florian Wirtz is one of the most creative and dangerous players in the world, being dropped into an already incredibly overloaded attack. And then you've got really interesting, quote-unquote, defensive players behind him in Gravenberch and McAllister, who have really good progressive and, you know, creation from deep. So I think he's going to go into a team where I think he's going to get a load of chances. I think he, which we'll get into, we'll probably get into it now, but he has unknowns, he has concerns. But I think given the price of Isak versus the price of Ekitike, which wasn't huge, but also we've got to remember, like, Gyökeres has gone for 15 mil under that. 10 mil under that.
And he's 27. It's like 56 guaranteed, rising to like
64.
I think it's about 64. Yeah, all in.
So yeah, he's a touch under what Ekitike is, but it's 27. Sesko, apparently the asking price, we're looking at triple figures. Whether anybody will go for that, who knows? But in the market of available young forwards, or forwards that are pre-peak or in their peak right now, in context, it kind of looks like a pretty decent deal. It is a risk. It is a lot of money. But I think the outlay that they would have had to spend to get somebody else would have been significantly more, and also present bigger risks in itself, just from players being older or being significantly more expensive.
Yeah, I think Ekitike, I guess it's hard to quantify this, but he's probably like the most talented striker prospect on the market this year. I mean, there is someone like Nick Voltomada, but I assume he's just going to go to Bayern. Šeško has amazing raw tools, but he needs to do a lot of stuff to become a top striker. Ekitike, if he just was the guy he appears to be, he is a top striker already, yeah. You know, and what he can do is he could do the running in behind like Nunez has done for them previously, but he's much more skillful on the ball. He's much more creative. He's way more comfortable dropping into the wide areas and dribbling at people, which Nunez doesn't do anymore. Like after leaving Portugal, he never did that anymore. And he does all this while having really high shot volume, really high expected goals. The issues are he plays in a Frankfurt team, which is really good at maximizing its forwards. And actually, Frankfurt historically have always built systems along these lines. You know, when you think about the forwards who've come out of the Frankfurt over the last few years that people pay big money for, it's like Sebaler, Luka Jovic, Randall Kolo Muani, Omar Marmoush, Ugo Ekitike.
Yeah, and production line.
All of those have gone for massive money. And of those guys, like Aller had a good career, but at a lower level. Marmoush looks good. Ekitike looks good, but the history is not great for those players, which is not a knock on him, but I'm just saying that like Frankfurt are really good at doing this. And he's coming to a tougher league. Generally speaking, players coming from the Bundesliga to the Prem might hope to keep 70 to 80% of their output. Okay, well, he's at like 0.9 expected goals right now. So that's putting us down to the 0.6, 0.7 range. Okay, that's really good. But you also saw him jump up from last season, like 0.5 expected goals per 90, which is still good for a young player, to 0.9 this season. Okay, how much of that is a real increase? That's him getting better. And how much of it is like maybe a hot season, like maybe the team just clicked perfectly for him, all this kind of stuff? That's a question as well. So if this last season was slightly better than you could expect him to be, I'm not saying it is, but say that's the case, and he's more of a 0.7 expected goal per 90 guy, and then we expect to only get like 70 to 80% of that. Now you're looking at like 0.5 to 0.6 expected goals and assists per 90. So there are lots of ways that you can imagine he goes from being like an amazing player who's going to be a superstar to Liverpool to like just pretty good. On the other hand, he's pre-peak. And while we can argue that, like, Frankfurt juice attackers numbers, Liverpool pretty capable of doing that as well.
Yeah.
Like, Liverpool, he's going to get tons of chances. He's got Salah and Wirtz around him. And the fit of him, like, the actual style of player he is, I do think is perfect. Like, if you've got Mo Salah there, the whole plan for Liverpool is going to be, we need to get Salah chances. Like, they've signed him up to this huge new contract, and Salah is in decline. Now, when I say that, like, I know that people will be like, fuck off, like, look at his last season. His output's not in decline, but physically, he is in decline. And the way you could tell this is that Liverpool are getting him to do less stuff. So Salah used to have, like, world-beating goal and assist output, but he also did tons of progressive carrying, and he pressed really hard. This last season, we didn't see him pressing like that. Like, the whole team would drop back to defend. Salah would stay on the halfway line waiting for a chance to run. Like, you don't see him doing as much progressive carrying anymore. He certainly doesn't really dribble anymore. Now, this is good. This is smart. This is Liverpool finding a way to maximise him. But next season, they're still going to be thinking, how do we maximise him? And one of the ways to do it is to have a striker who's comfortable dropping out of the box, filling space out wide while Salah moves central. Yeah. And in that sense, like, I think Ekitike is kind of perfect for it. So he doesn't even need to have huge goal output himself for this to be successful, at least over the next couple of years. So long as he's like creative enough and he runs the channels enough and he's like enough of a one-on-one threat and he gets a few goals, like, Liverpool will be happy. And I suspect he will get more than a few goals. I mean, when you look at his stats, is there stuff in it that like you like or that worries you?
So I think there are both, but the staying on the kind of his ball carrying abilities, his ability to kind of facilitate players around him or make stuff happen that you wouldn't say a traditional number nine would. He's so willing to drop in, and he's good enough on the ball to help progress. So if Salah isn't going to do anywhere near as much of that as he would have done in his prime, Ekitike can facilitate that. If you look at like his involvement in build-up play last season, he got 44 shots off carries, which was behind in Europe's top five, behind only Mbappe, Yamal, and a player that we don't talk about. So he was fourth in Europe's top five leagues for the amount of shots he was able to get off carries. So he is super comfortable getting the ball to his feet and making something happen. He's not amazing as a creative player, but he doesn't necessarily need to be the assister of that. And also, in saying that, he still had double figures assist across the Bundesliga and Europa League last season. So he is not useless in that regard, but no, he doesn't necessarily need to be that final assister. He can just link up play. He can just get the ball on the feet and make a sensible move or pass to help move everybody up the pitch. He can facilitate that, and that frees Salah up to be a lot more free. Pressing wise, he can pick up anything that Salah, you know, puts down in the sense that Salah kind of steps off the pressing. He's felt very, very comfortable being very good and intense presser. He was over 15 high pressures per 90 last season, highest in Frankfurt, which you would imagine as like the trigger of their press. But that fits well into what Liverpool would want him to do. He'll be that. If he plays through, he will play through the middle.
But he's done it in a two and sure, as a sole striker.
So I guess you could play him with Nunez if you... I don't really see a system where they would.
Yeah, but I more mean that like...
He's not going to be out on a limb on his own, basically.
Well, and he understands that like, okay, when you're the sole striker, this is what you need to do. When you're playing in a two, these are your responsibilities. Like he's had to do this kind of tactical education, which feels like it'll be a good practice for Liverpool.
So I would be very, very confident in him being very comfortable in leading that line and being the kind of the trigger, the first point of that press, and doing that effectively. His movement's really intelligent in the box as well. He's getting around seven touches in opposition boxes. He had the most shots, six most shots inside the box in the Bundesliga last season. So a sign of a good forward is being able to find space where it looks like there isn't much space, and consistently find space, and also consistently get shots off. He had the most shots of anybody in the league last season. So he has a lot of these unfinished qualities that he should still need to improve on, but already is showing in a decent league. Again, it's not an amazing league, but also Frankfurt aren't an incredibly dominant entity in that league. It's not like he's leading the line for Bayern and just hammering like a load of bumfuck teams. There is an element where he is in a more, not average might be harsh to Frankfurt, but a more average team than, say, one of the two elite teams in the Bundesliga. He is going to come in to a truly elite team in the Premier League. He is going to be playing in front of Wirtz, who was 10th in the Bundesliga for chance creations last season. He's going to be in the middle of Salah, who was second in the Premier League for chance creations. Frimpong was top 10 for chances from defenders in the Bundesliga. He is going to get a lot of chances. He's going to get a lot of ball because Liverpool had, I think, the second highest possession in the league last season. Maybe the highest. Anyway, it was like 60-odd%. So Liverpool are going to have a load of ball. They are going to play that into him and expect him to hold it up and make intelligent decisions to help progress them up the pitch. He's going to be involved in a huge amount of ways. And everything up to this point has shown that he's fully capable of doing that as a 23-year-old. So you expect him, as he approaches the peak years, to only get better and better and better. Okay, there is the caveat that he is entering a much more difficult, more physical league. Remains to be seen how he deals with that. But from what we've seen in the Bundesliga, generally speaking, everything I've just mentioned should translate fairly well into him in the Premier League as a Liverpool striker. The one thing that is concerning, and that he does need to become a lot more efficient in, his finishing. So I think he can be frustrating as a finisher. He got 15 league goals last season, but they came from 21.5 expected goals. So he was underperforming by about 6 goals from his expected goals versus goals, which was by far the biggest underperformance in the Bundesliga. We're talking like over double or around double the underperformance of the second most underperforming person
in the league. But historically, like, every other season of his career, he's been above XG. Right? I mean, it is just one season that he's had that's like this. Like I don't think you can really draw any conclusions from it.
I think you can say that, sure, if it's one season, but it is a concerning underperformance, and sure, it could just be a rough season, but it's a bit of a concern if you're that much of an underperformance across a full season, because it is a decent enough sample size. My, I guess, counterpoint to that concern would be that if he's getting 15 goals from 21 XG, say that is his output, just for argument's sake, say that is his consistent output. In this Liverpool team, who can create, who should be able to create an immense amount of chances for him, in his first season, if he gets 16 goals from 24 XG or 17 league goals from 24 XG, that's a good first season. Even though he left a lot of goals out there, that's a very, very good first season for a 23-year-old in the Premier League. So I think if Liverpool can create enough for him, and obviously, like you say, you're kind of facilitating maximising Salah's output for as long as they can, but he will get chances. There are so many creative players around him that he will get chances. His XG will be, especially as such an intelligent mover in the box, knows how to get on the ball, can get on the ball in multiple ways. He can drop deep, mm-hmm. He can stay in the box, he can find space where it doesn't look like there's space, he can get shots off when it doesn't look like other players will be able to. He is very efficient at that. That will translate to goals just by volume. So at this stage, I'm less worried about his efficiency from last season, just because if you throw enough shit at the wall, a lot of it will stick. And it'll give him time, a season or two, to kind of just develop into what is expected of him as a Premier League forward, at which point he would then be 25, peak age.
So yeah, I think, same age as Isak now.
Yeah, so I think Liverpool are in such a good position that they don't need to rely on him for a ton of goals, because they're going to rely on Salah. And they've also still got Nunes, who's a shot monster, who, if he's still there at the start of the season, we'll see, will also be expected to heavily be involved. You've got Virch, you've got Gakpo, you've got Diaz. You know, you've got a load of attacking entities there that will shoulder a lot of the goal scoring and output burden. So I think it's a really good position for Ekotike to be coming in and still contribute healthily, but not be the sole provider of goals, yeah, and be able to develop into a player that by the time he hit peak age, I could easily see him as one of the best goal scoring forwards in the Premier League.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like, I think that anybody playing up front for Liverpool is going to get chances, and I think that fans are likely to get on his back. Like, if he were to underperform expected goals, though, the thing is, like, normally you need like 500 shots to be able to tell if somebody's an underperformer. Like, this is the thing. Like, when we always talk about it as like one season, but it's
like 120 last season.
Yeah, it's just not a big enough sample, like, to have a sort of like certainty about it. Like, there have been a few studies done on this, and it's just like, it's much more likely that he'll just score at XG rate next season. Like, that's honestly my opinion. But Nunez underperformed. Like, Nunez got like 13 goals from 20 XG or something in his first season, something like that. But the frustration was that Nunez doesn't really give you much if he's not scoring goals.
Yeah, yeah.
He gets chances that nobody has a right to get, but nobody gives him credit for that. Nobody says, oh, yes, he missed this chance, but that chance wouldn't exist if he were another player.
Yeah.
They just got annoyed that he was missing the chance. With Ekitike, even if this were the same next year and he missed loads of chances, I think you'll get so much out of him creatively and in link-up play. And because he's like young, there'll be the idea of like, look, this is a project guy. We got this guy because we couldn't get Isak, so we know that this guy is not the finished article.
Yeah.
I think that people will understand a little bit more if he has some issues just putting the ball in the net, because that's not his whole game. But
yeah,
I mean, Liverpool overall, we won't go into this too much, I still think that they should do a 3-4-3. Like, I still don't really understand it if that's not the plan, because I don't think Frimpong can play pure right back in the Premier League. I just don't think he can, especially not with an aging Salah in front of him as the winger. No way. I still think maybe they think Bradley's going to be the right back and Frimpong's going to be a utility forward and maybe like get some right back minutes. Yeah. I think if they want to move to a three at the back, though, they need to buy another centre back. So, like, but they've already spent 300 mil. Yeah. So, I don't know. If they sell Nunez and they sell Luis Diaz to Bayern, then that's going to be like 100 mil, but like more than 120 mil.
Who's your backup centre forward and who's your backup left wing?
Well, this is the thing. I think I wouldn't really worry about the centre forward too much.
Gakpo for left and nobody else.
But this is part of the problem, though, which is like, I mean, I think Liverpool as well will be trying to work out what's going on. After Diogo Jota, like, I think that the club must be like just fucking reeling. The players and the coach must just be like really struggling with it. And then, you know, as tasteless as it feels, there are going to be people at the club who are paid to think about, like, okay, what do we do with this squad now? So that's going to be another consideration as well. But, like, I don't know, like,
I don't think that's tasteless, though. That's just like the reality that they've been put into in a very unfortunate circumstance.
I know. But it's just like, I don't know. I think that Diaz and Nunez, like, I think maybe in an ideal world, Liverpool would be like, let's keep as much of this together. But I think the Diaz money is going to get so high, they won't be able to say no. If they end up having to keep Nunez for another year, okay, they'll get less for him next year, but it will be completely fine. Like, okay, now you've got a really good backup striker. Great.
Yeah.
I still think that the change of shape makes sense. I would not want Frimpong to be my starting pure right back in the Premier League. Especially, I also just don't think that you can really bank on Van Dijk and Konate both staying fit and having like another perfect campaign where even still the defense was only very good. It wasn't amazing. You know, like, I just think there are questions there. It would make more sense for me to go to the 3-4-3, but
I'm slightly more bullish on a 4-3-1 with Frimpong as a right back, but you would then kind of go, you would consolidate and go slightly more isometric in possession or to protect against being countered on, and that you would shift to almost a back three with Kirk.
But Kirkez has shown absolutely no ability to do that. Like, Kirkez is a flying left back. Like, Kirkez wants to run forward. Like, if you were playing Robertson instead, then like maybe you could do that. But like, to me, it still makes sense if they go and get an in between a left back, centre back. Like, that's what would make the most sense for me. Who can play in a back three? Who can potentially grow into the Van Dijk role? And I think just like allows you to do that sometimes with Frimpong, but I don't know. To me, that's scary because I still think that midfield has like defensive questions. I think Kravenberg had a really good season, but the idea that he has just become like an elite defensive midfielder, I think is bullshit. I think he's a really good controlling playmaker. I'd still worry a little bit about that, especially Salah a little bit older, Van Dijk a little bit older, and Konate's injury history has been kind of up and down his whole career. That's kind of the problem.
Yeah, I think...
And he's in the last year of his deal.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think it's without risk. I think there are significant risks here, but I kind of feel like they're just rolling with it and saying that...
Yeah, fine.
That they're going to be able to bully enough teams that it not be that much of an issue.
And then, I think they'll sign someone else.
Do you think? They spent 300 mil already, though.
Yeah, but I think their attitude is like, if we've re-signed Van Dijk and Salah, if we're not going to go for it, if we're going to leave like
this
a massive...
Like the band's final tour.
What's the point of spending a ton on these guys who are there to win now if you're then going to leave like massive gaping holes in the squad? You might as well sign these guys, especially because you're going to have to sign them at some point. Like, if you go and buy a centre-back now, it's not like you're not going to need that player in 2 years. You are going to need him in 2 years. So from Liverpool's point of view, like... If they just leave big holes in the squad and they go into the season and they're like, okay, we're just hoping Van Dijk and Konate are fit all season because they've also shipped Kwanzaa out, then I would think, but then why did you re-sign Van Dijk and Salah? Because like the whole thing with Van Dijk and Salah should have been, we're going to win. We're going to win now. Wiertz is a perfect... Wiertz and Ekitike are fine because you're like... And even Kerkez is fine because you're like, all those signings are like... they'll be good now and they'll be good in the future and you needed them anyway. But if you don't also make the kind of backup signings that solidify the team, then the team's floor is lower than you'd like, even if its ceiling is as high as it's ever been, you know?
Yeah, I'm less concerned about fullbacks / wingbacks because I think there's still a lot of value in Bradley and Robertson. It's the centre-back DM triangle is the area of concern for me. Because like you say, McAllister and Gravenberch as their starting DMs, neither of whom are like absolute out and out defensive midfielders. So if you require a defensive midfielder for whatever scenario, you don't really have a natural one there. And you were thin last season at centre-back, and you've shipped one of your centre-backs out, so you're incredibly thin now. And one of them super old, or getting, well, what, Van Dijk's 34? 30, must be.
Yeah, something like that.
Kanate's not signing, it doesn't look like he's signing a new deal. So rolling into the season with those three as your, with three centre-backs, is risky.
It just doesn't feel like a Liverpool thing to do.
Yeah.
But like, I just think they'll have more. I think they'll have planned it out more than that, and I think they'll have been like.
But the same risk kind of exists if you then go to three at the back with three centre backs, because then you're just one injury away from having zero cover.
Yeah, but one of those injuries happens, and you can go to the back four.
Back four, yeah.
Like, I mean, like it's not ideal. Also, yeah, like yes, one injury is bad, but like when you have an extra player, one injury is not as bad as it is if you didn't have that extra player, right? Like, yes.
Yeah, but it is bad when you require an extra player like that on the pitch.
Sure, but you can still then go into your back four. Whereas if they don't sign that player, they can't play the back three unless they want to play Robertson there or something. And if that player gets injured, then they can barely do the back four. Like, I mean, like either way, you need a centre back.
Yeah.
So I wonder if now we're seeing like, you know, Chelsea move for Yorohato or something. Like, wonder now if Liverpool are like, okay, and this is maybe the last thing we do this summer.
It's just so much money outlaid in one window. It's crazy.
I know, but you've got to think about it in whatever it is, 3-year cycles, haven't you? You know, what's okay with PSR? From Liverpool's point of view, they'll be like, well, we invest
if
now.
If we win everything as well.
Well, and they can bring in quite a bit of money. Like, yeah. Again, if they sell Luis Diaz, then that's like, it looks like it would be like 70 mil from Bayern Munich. That is so much money.
Yeah, there's a lot of money. And their like global revenue will be at like a all-time modern high, I'd imagine. Like modern era all-time high. So that also gives them a lot more maneuverability PSR-wise.
Sure. All right. Well, I think that's Liverpool taken care of. Should we move on to the Burn Book? Okay, burn book time. Should we go in? Shall we go out?
Let's start positive.
Okay.
Do you want me to start? I can start. Mine's not that interesting. Yeah, you start. Mine's not that interesting. It's just something that I find...
Just what? Love to hear it.
Incredibly... Well, it might be interesting to some people. I find it interesting. I feel that my retelling of this could be, I don't know, dry. But it was a very, very cathartic experience for me. And what I'm taking out of the burn book this week... Or is unsubscribing to mailing lists. This is something that I just unknowingly or just accidentally, I fell asleep at the wheel managing my emails, Patrick, managing my email accounts. And it got to a stage and I hadn't really thought about it, but I would have like multiple thousands of unread emails. And the landscape of my email inbox
is crazy.
My personal email inbox would be so over like run with just random shit. Marketing shit from a website that I haven't bought anything off in 4 years, or like I signed up to this mailing list 4 years ago because it was a first time purchase and it got me 10% off whatever I bought back then. I've never been back to that shop since, yet I'm still getting like weekly emails from them. this happens like times 100 with all of these different companies, and it's just like been building and building over the years to the extent where like when I actually have to use my emails for something I actually want to do, when I have to find something, when I have to like go back to find an email to get a reference number for something, it's an absolute pain because like the Apple email app function, whatever, is horrendous for searching. Half of the stuff you search for, it doesn't find. It's just a horrendous interface. But that plus like 5,000 random emails dotted about in between everything makes it an absolute nightmare to like navigate. And while I bitch and shit on the Apple email app, it does have one incredibly useful function that I've been using for the past week or two, and that is when it senses that you are getting emails from a mailing subscription list, at the very, very top it just gives you an option like an out of the email button just to say unsubscribe. This email was from a mailing list, do you want to unsubscribe? You don't have to scroll the whole way to the bottom and go onto the website and all that. So at any time, I've just been like over the past week or two, checking my emails in the morning, seeing anything that's like, oh, that's a mailing list, open it up, unsubscribe. And I've just been doing that for like 10 minutes at the start of each day. And it's been weirdly cathartic. And I'm already seeing improvements. My emails are much less cluttered at the minute. The stuff that's coming in tends to be stuff that is of note and of interest, mm-hmm. not just sure. fodder. And yeah, it's something that I have no idea why I was asleep at the wheel for so long, or why I just accepted that like my email had become this dumping ground of shite and basically rendered it not necessarily useless, but incredibly difficult to use. Mm-hmm. And then just one day, like 2 weeks ago, I was like, I'm just going to unsubscribe to all these guys.
And to be honest, it's exactly, it does sound exactly like what a 30-something man with ADHD's email inbox would look like.
Yeah.
Like that is kind of what it sounds like. So when you say, like, I can't understand why it's that way, I'm like, Pete, like, you do not like having to do jobs.
No, I do not.
And I can imagine you opening your email inbox, looking at it and being like, fuck this, and just immediately closing it, which we've all done.
But I do that. I also do that at work. People email me at work and are like, oh, did you see that email I sent you last week? And I'm like, I don't read my emails. I don't read my work emails.
Fucking I would love to know.
Message me if you want something, because that'll actually like pop up somewhere that I might read. If you're emailing me at work, I'm not reading it.
I would love to know how many emails I replied to in my 8 years at FD. Like from my FD email account, I honestly reckon it was in like double digits. I was just like, it doesn't matter. Like, okay. if you want to do a deal, don't email me.
Right.
Like, don't get in touch with me.
I've worked at my current company for coming up on 6 years. How many unread emails do you think there are in my work inbox?
6 years. Fuck. 7,000?
21,221.
Oh my God. So 3,500 a year,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, it sounds like you're a great employee. I'm glad that you've discovered pressing the button that everybody else just presses in the thing. But like, if it's making life easier for you, Pete, then I approve of it, you know?
Yeah, and currently I only have 1,800 unread emails on my personal
account. Pretty good.
Pretty good. But getting low.
But I think, you know, this is the sort of thing where I'm like, every now and then, like, I'm very pro-technology, but it does feel a lot of the time like technology does stuff that people who run technology companies kind of think it should do, or that they think they can market to investors. And it's quite rare that somebody's like, hey, what if we just did this thing that made life easier for everybody?
Yeah.
In the same way that like government like knows nothing about the internet, because it's all old people who don't go on the internet, which is why 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you would just go to a website. And now when you go to a website, you have to close all the fucking, all the pop-ups and shit, all the consent stuff.
You have to accept all the cookies and all that bullshit, yeah.
Yeah, but it was just like, the internet was so good before this.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of things. I might have mentioned this before, but when I changed internet provider, that is fucking amazing. That's really good. Because all you do is say to the new company, I want to sign up with you. They get in touch with the old company. The old company says, this is how much your termination cost is. If you have a termination cost, do you want to go ahead? And you just click yes or no. And if you click yes, then they just switch you over to the new internet. So all you have to do is click sign up with this one and then click yes or no with this other one. And that's it. That's all I did to change internet. And they just billed me out of the previous one and started my bill for the next one. Like it was genuine. It's like one click change. That was like the rare example of legislation and technology combining to actually make life better, as opposed to make it more tedious and annoying. This is another example, I think.
I had a kind of similar experience, but I had to kind of manufacture for myself. So there was a newspaper provider that I subscribed to for ages, and mm-hmm. I just kept seeing the money come out of my account each month, and I'm like, I barely use this. But the difficulty to leave them, you have to phone them up and be like,
sure,
I want to leave, I want to cancel, and you like get put on hold. And
that's mental.
I like, you physically have to phone them. And you get
ChatGPT should be able to do it.
And they give you like the hard sell, and then they do their like fake, oh, let me check with my manager about a discount, and that comes back like four times. And it's just a whole fucking 30 minute, like tedious exercise just to not give them money. So I was like, I just kept putting it off. And I was like, you know what, fuck this. I'm going to go on their live chat. And I went on their live chat, and they're like, filled out their like automated questions. They're like, oh, you need to phone this number. And I was like, speak to customer assistant, please. So they put me through to somebody. And then I just straight up just typed to them, being like, I'm currently not able to speak at the minute, so I can't use your phone number. Here are my account details. Can I cancel my subscription? And they were like, "Do you, so just to confirm you want to cancel your subscription?" I was like, yes. And they were like, okay, it's cancelled.
Oh, amazing.
And
I love it when that
was
happens.
For me to lie about my ability or lack thereof to physically speak.
Every now and then you get a customer service person, though, who is just like a normal.
Yeah.
And you can say to them, you're just like, bro, like, I'm not going to buy any of this shit.
Yeah.
Of course I don't want a fucking landline. Like, come on. Yeah. And then they're just like, okay.
But also, Patrick, I think you're underestimating the lengths I would go to not speak to people.
Sure.
Like, physically speak to people.
I don't care about the speaking. I just need it to be as quick as possible. Mm. So whether that's speaking or emailing, I don't really care. But I just need it to be, like, as fast as it can possibly be. So sometimes it is good to ring someone up and just be like, no, I'm telling you right now, like, you don't, like, skip to the end, skip to the end, skip to the end, skip to the end. Don't need to read it to me. Skip to the end. And after a while, they're just like, okay, all right, that's cancelled.
I think I've always been like 100% live chat guy. But
live chat takes longer, though, because I'm sorry to hear that you are having problems with your internet service. You're like, no, you're not sorry. You're not a fucking real person.
So,
and that's true even if you are a real person. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're not a real person to me.
I've always preferred that experience because, like, even the lack of efficiency was just more like palatable because I'm not speaking to someone until I had to go through the whole car claims insurance thing, and then I was I was literally just phoning them like twice a day, being like, "Can you just fucking tell me what's going on?" Because it was just so much more efficient. But outside of that, big life tracker.
Okay, well, I do think that this is a situation where we should be able to get ChatGPT to do it. I think ChatGPT should be able to ring up a service for you, and it should be like, "Hello, my name is Pete Darman. I would like to cancel my online subscription, please." You know, like, that does feel like something it should be able to do. But, okay, it's a good one. It's a good one. Okay, what am I taking out of the burn book? I saw this described this way online. CRAP. C-R-A-P. And what this stands for is candles, rugs, art, and plants. And I was like, that's great. That's really helpful. I haven't even needed to check since, like, what it stands for. It just stays in there. And recently, I was just like, our upstairs bathroom, we had it redone when we moved in. It's very nice. Mm. But also, it was like, I had this wicker basket that was kind of, like, functioning as the bin, but it's at the top of the house, so I just fucking never take it down on the day we do recycling. So it's just full of, like, you know, paper and stuff. And just generally speaking, I was like, this room just needs to be zhuzhed up a bit because, like, it's a nice room. But, you know, it's always like, you know, when you wear your short, you're like running shorts for a run, but you're just like, well, I'm going to go for a run tomorrow. And like, I'm not going for a run at fucking Buckingham Palace. I'll just wear the same running shorts I wore today. Yeah. So you like put them somewhere to like kind of dry off and you're like, wear them tomorrow. But so that's what the bathroom ends up having. It ends up having like the shorts I wear in bed in there. It ends up having my running shorts in there. It's got like this wicker basket, which kind of looks a bit shit because it doesn't have a lid on it, so you can just see all the rubbish in it. Like, there's just like empty space and stuff. Like, I was like, I just need to make this nice. Yeah. So I just spent some money on some plants, and I spent some money on plant for my bedroom as well. Mm. And I got a new bin to go up there, which is like a 2/3 bin. So there's like a small side for like actual rubbish, and then a larger side for recycling because it's basically all recycling. It's like, you know, loo rolls or like paper or whatever. Or like, you know, empty you know, like toiletry tubes,
bottles,
like that kind of thing. Yeah, so most of it's recycling. So I was like, okay, big recycling side. And generally speaking, every now and then, like every few months, I'm just like, I want to have some candles. I maybe want to get some new art on the walls. Like, I want to get some plants and stuff. And it always hurts when I do it. I'm always just like, fuck me, 50 quid on fucking plants that my wife's going to kill. Like, really? Am I going to do this? But then actually, when you do it, you walk into your house and you're like, this is much nicer. Like, I really do think that putting art on the walls especially is like the number one thing you can do to make your house nicer. Like, that is the thing that I spent ages doing when we moved in. And now there is art like all over the house, all over the walls. And it does just feel like an actual place rather than like temporary.
Well. Yeah.
So sometimes I think if you're in this zone and you've got a little bit of money to spend, like if you kind of are like, my room's like bumming me out at the moment, like there might be a problem in there you can solve for one. So like you might just be able to get like a nicer, like if you look at your wash basket and it always kind of looks shit, you could just get a nicer one. Or if you always have clothes that, you know, not dirty enough to go in the washing, not clean enough to go in the drawer, you can get yourself like a little rack that will just hold those, put that in your room. Like, yeah, you can extend it to that stuff. And suddenly you're like, oh, why didn't I do this before? This looks way nicer now. Like, so that is what I'm trying to do at the moment. Like, when I walk into a room and I think, I can't put my finger on why, but this room is fucking bumming me out.
Mm.
I spend some time trying to put my finger on why. And often it is just like these small upgrades. Like, you know, I have a little tray even that goes on my bedside table that holds like my watches and jewelry and stuff. You know, like things like that. You're like, it's better than having to shove it in a drawer or having to put it somewhere weird.
It never goes in the drawer either when you use it regularly. It always just gets sat on the side.
Exactly. It just rattles around. And you just, and I know, you know, look, if you don't have children as well, like having a rack for like magazines and things, like those things can be really helpful. Having a rack for, you know, you might have a place you keep your records like we do in the kitchen, but then there's normally a stack that are out by the record player because they're in slightly different places. I just think I'm going to get a little rack for that as well that just improves the situation. So I think there are all sorts of little things like this that when you do them, suddenly you're like, oh, because I think telling yourself just not to dump shit on the like that surface or that surface never works. It especially never works when you tell your wife to do it. Because she doesn't. Well, I mean, as in, like, if somebody tells you, you're like, I don't care. You need to make them care. And I can't make my wife care because she doesn't mind it. So the way to do it is to be like, here is a place for you to put the thing, and then she will put it there, rather than just like, don't make a mess. I think that helps.
Yeah, at the minute we have the chair for myself, which is like, it's an imperfect solution, but like, it's a nice chair that my mum upholstered. But when I lived in Belfast before I met Jess, I bought this like standalone Scandi style like full length mirror, but at the back of it was this rail that extended round, which you would use to hang your dirty but not too dirty clothes.
That's good.
So you just put them on a hanger, hang them up. So I would have like, I don't know, if I wore like a shirt to work, because I was working like in a newspaper back then, I was like, I've only worn this, like, literally only wore this to work, and it's actually fine. I could probably use it again later in the week. Or like your trousers or whatever, you would just hang them up on a hanger, hang them behind the thing. They're kind of tucked away neatly. You don't really see them. They also stay in like good condition because they're not like tossed on the floor. It's just, it's a tiny difference, but the impact it has on the rest of the room is quite substantial.
Yeah, agreed. Like, I think you just want your house to look like you have it this way on purpose. And there are parts of our house that can't be that way. Like the kids, like Coco's room is not really like that. And to be honest, the downstairs, like, it's just like, there's shit there for the kids. Like, it's just the way it has to be.
Mm.
But when it comes to like the upstairs bathroom, they never go in. When it comes to our bedroom, especially because when it comes to the end of the day, you want to go into your bedroom and have it be like an actually relaxing place, not a fucking shit tip, like full of issues to be solved. Mm. So I'm trying to do that with the bedroom right now. I'm trying to declutter and just generally make it nicer. What are you putting in the burn book this week?
What I am putting in the burn book this week are old finance bros.
Mm, sure.
The aged of the finance world. Yeah, there's just something inherently like just sad about these guys. You can spot them a mile off. I work kind of in between the City of London and Shoreditch. So like
Patagonia,
I'm right.
Patagonia, quarter zip.
It's like, you can spot them a mile off because they dress significantly more casually than like their other try-hard finance bros who are still really trying to impress and trying to climb the way up the ladder. They've not reached like Adam Sandler vibes, but it kind of reminds me of in The Big Short, Christian Bale's character who runs the hedge fund, who's coming in like shorts and flip-flops. Not to that level. Like, they still look smart, but they're definitely significantly more casual than the people they're with. But it's just because they're kind of significantly past trying to impress people. Like, they've got enough skin in the game that they can kind of do what they want in their company, I imagine.
Okay, so I'm intrigued to hear how this is going to take a turn, because that sounds like a person you can admire. They earn a ton of money and they don't give a shit. Is that not your ideal person?
My issue is that they all, while they are seasoned veterans in the game, they all try to convince everybody that they're still 22 years old, despite being like in their mid-50s, resented by their fourth wife and their estranged children. Like, their lives could not be more like approaching pensioner age in terms of the structure of how their like outside of work life is, but they are so hell-bent on, or they, at least the ones that I see coming home from work, when I stop off at a pub for a couple of drinks with some friends, they're all about, because again, like I am in the, for me to get home from work, I walk to London Bridge, which means I walk through like the belly of the beast here. I see them everywhere and you spot them a mile off and it's like, they're 55, 60, grey, but they're just like super loud. They're like hammering drinks. They're like making other people drink. Like the behavior you would expect to see at like a university group. They are, in many of them, are seemingly like loaded to the tits on cocaine or some other class A drugs. And it's just like, I loved, outside of the class A drug stuff, I loved doing stuff like that when I was at uni. I loved when I was like 22, 23, doing all that stuff. I'm now 34. And while I still love to go out and have drinks with friends and stuff, the dynamic has shifted and I'm very happy that it shifted. I couldn't think of anything worse to be 10 years older than I am now, but still trying to act like I did when I was 22. It just seems so, it just doesn't fit well. It just seems so strange. It seems so try hard. And then like you can almost see the guys that they're with. They don't think it's cool. They're not like, oh, this guy is so great. They're kind of doing it out of obligation because of the seniority of the person. They're like, this guy's like a fucking director. He's like my double line manager or my second tier line manager or whatever, third tier. I kind of have to, if this guy's like bought me 2 Jaeger bombs and a pint and tells me that we're going to drink them together in the next 4 minutes, I'm going to do it. So it's just this level of like try-hardedness for a guy who really should be home with his family. And you know, because the thing is, like, university,
it's second family,
it's fourth family, for me, it just shows no personal progression on like a individual level. And maybe they're in the middle of a midlife crisis. Maybe they're all in like midlife crisis. Who knows? But for me, growing into my like 30s, I've been like, you gain more perspective, and things that used to matter don't matter anymore. Things that didn't matter to you now really matter to you, and like you're kind of shift your what's important to you shifts throughout the various stages of life. I just find it hard to understand how middle age you could still like be so concerned about what the like 25-year-olds in your company like that they think you're cool. I couldn't give a fuck, and that like you have this perception that you're still this like cool party boy, because it's almost exclusively men as well. And just there's just something inherently quite sad and pathetic about it. But you know, there's these guys who earn shitloads of money but just are, you know, they just wanted their dad to tell them that he loved them.
And you know that, you know who they are as well from the time you meet them when you're like 18. Like the people who in the fourth year of uni were still like going out with all the freshers to try and hook up with like girls who had just turned 18. You knew those guys.
Yeah.
We're going to be the same. And I even remember like years later, like talking to some of those people and they would still be like, oh, I just love a big night out. Me, like, it's my favorite thing, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, that's because you can't find anybody to love you. Like,
yeah.
It's because you're rotten inside. I just think you can get fucked up. Getting fucked up at home with your friends at like a dinner party when you're 60 is still cool. You can do that forever. Like, that's great. But publicly, you can get fucked up in public and get loaded like on whatever up until you're maybe 32, 33. After that, it's not cute. After about 68, 70, starts to get cool again. Because if you're out on the street you're not just like a total like you're not like rotting in the corner of a pub, but you're like 75 and you're still kind of cool and you just love cocaine, I'm fine with that. Like go live your best life, like that's fine. But the in-between bit where it's just like, yeah, I'm still cool, it's just like, why are you even doing this cocaine? Like, what are you going to do afterwards? Like, you're going to go home to your wife and your wife's going to be like, oh, Gary, Jesus, like sleep in the spare room, you fucking smell of beer. And in the morning, you know, you'll just like tumble downstairs into the kitchen, head off to work at like 6 a.m. again.
And just repeat.
Miss your children's bedtime and do it all again. Yeah. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just, I agree. It's tragic. But I do think that some of it comes round. If you can just wait until you're old enough that it's kind of ironic, then it becomes cool again. All right. What am I putting in the burn book? Oh, dating.
Okay. I can't imagine that you've had much experience of that recently, though.
No. And yet, it's everywhere. Every time I open Instagram, I feel like I'm seeing clips from like what seem to be like YouTube or like online dating shows where it's kind of like it'll be comedians or it'll be like YouTube. You know, it'll be like I Show Speed, that weird cunt. Like it'll be people like that in a lineup with some like IG baddies. And you're like, this isn't real dating because obviously nobody here is going to hook up. Like half of you aren't even single.
The kind of like Tinder in real life thing. Swipe left.
And I think all it does as well is like give you the impression, it's really judgy. You know, it'd be like, oh, pop your balloon. And some guy walks in and he's just like, oh, I'm a teacher. And they all pop their balloons. And they're like, oh, teachers don't earn enough. Or, you know, that kind of shit. It's always this horrible stuff that I think if I were single and I were dating would make me feel bad about myself. But as a person who's not dating, I do just think that like I see this stuff everywhere. I see Love Island stuff everywhere. Even when you think about any other aspect of your life or talk about it. I mean, admittedly, I'm in this space at the moment because of Man Down and we do talk about dating there. But like if you talk about clothes or exercise or cooking or whatever, somehow people always bring it back to dating as if everything is about trying to get the maximum number of people to fuck you. Well, the really important thing is like that you can get in shape so that people want to fuck you. Mm. Oh, the really important thing is that you can earn more money because then more people want to fuck you. Oh, well, if you learn to cook, then you can really impress people on a date. Like all this, or you want to dress nicely, like for a first date, like all this kind of stuff. It's just like dating's actually a really small part of our lives. Like it really is. And it's not that interesting. Dating is chiefly done by very boring people, by which I mean people under 30, or like it's just not that intriguing to me as like a topic. And yet it feels like dating has become like a weirdly kind of like a weird genre of entertainment, you know, whether it's like Love Is Blind or fucking, you know, Mafsa at least kind of skips the date and just makes these people live together until they hate each other. But even Mafsa isn't fun except when it's in Australia and they're all insane.
But like, I think we always kind of had that though. Like we had Blind Date, Cilla Black, we had Take Me Out.
Yeah, but that was
which is kind of
there was basically one of these on TV at a time and it wasn't all over Instagram as well. Like it's more just the fact that I think I don't want everything I do to be about like to be somehow brought back to this thing. Like, I don't know. At the moment, it just seems like everywhere I go, people are talking about it and people are like wittering on about like, you know, basically pickup artist shit. It's all like demonstrations of higher value and like optimal shoulder to waist ratios and like all this kind of stuff. And I'm just like, just shut the fuck up. Like, how would you open with this person? It's just like, I don't know, like I'd probably just walk into the sea rather than like having to fucking talk to some IG baddie. Like I'd probably be like, I'm not really interested in you because your name's an abstract noun, like go the fuck away. Like I just find that it's kind of colonized a lot of our headspace, and as a person who intends never to date again, I'm not very interested.
Yeah, it feels like, obviously I've not dated in the best part of a decade, but it feels like now that there is a much more entrenched outlook on like what people want from or expect, like from the just even to open a conversation with somebody, like they have to be 6'2" or they have to earn X amount of money per year.
And they have like, to confirm the date on the day of the date, like all this kind of stuff.
The buy-in
cares.
From a lot of these kind of like cut downs that you see on social media, the buy-in just to get a seat at the table in any given date for with any given person seems to be so, so much higher than it used to be. Mm. And it's just like, it seems like, I imagine it'll be a soul-destroying like landscape right now. Because I quite enjoyed dating when I was younger. I thought it was quite fun.
Yeah, but
I don't know if I'd love this landscape.
I also think, this is kind of a wanky thing to say, but I also think that you and I pretty quite like dating because it played to our strengths. And so, I don't know about you, but I was certainly not interested in the mechanics of dating. I was like, I think I'm pretty good at this. Like, I think I can, if somebody looks at me and is open to us getting together, then I think I can then go on the date and be like charming and funny enough that like, at very least, I'll have represented myself as who I am. I'm not going to like clam up and have nothing to say. I'll be fine. Like at worst, they're like, I don't really vibe with you. Like, it's fine.
But then there are other people who bought that book, The Game. Is it The Game?
Yeah, it is The Game. Yeah. But like, I don't, but and to be clear, this isn't like me going at people who are like uncertain about how to date and want a bit of guidance. But I actually think all this stuff makes it worse because it basically is just like, well, don't even bother talking to somebody if you're not like 6 foot two and earning like, you know, six figures. Well, you know, before you even try and go on a date, what you obviously need to do is go and like work out and drop like 6% of your body fat. No, you don't. There are loads of people out there. You can just fucking talk to them. You can just ask them out.
Yeah.
And if they're just like, actually, like, what do you do for a living? Like, do you earn enough to date me? You can be like, oh, it turns out that we as a species should probably stop you creating more of you.
But also, like, you've told me everything I need to know about you to be like, actually, you know what? Mess me with that shit.
Yeah, just like, sorry, but your bloodline's going to die out. And like... And so it should, like, everybody as well should have somebody in their life who, if they do get really particular about stuff where they're just like, I actually need somebody to, like, why would you not bring flowers on a first date? Like, you're fucking bum. Like, everybody needs a friend in their life who says to them, I realize that going on about your high standards makes you feel like a valuable person, but you are going to die alone. Maybe consider trying not to do that. Like, so, look, I understand, like, dating's always going to interest people to some degree, but I just find that now, like, it's fucking overload. Like, it's just absolutely everywhere. And it's just like, don't you just want to see these hot people hook up? It's like, not really, because watching the people on Love Island hook up is honestly like watching the snooker. It's just like, this color ball bumps into this color ball, and like, that's kind of it. Then it like cannons away and bumps into another color ball. Like, that's basically what happens on Love Island, as far as I understand it. So
that's the most mental analogy I've ever heard.
But it's fucking true, right? Isn't it? Like you sit there watching it the same way that you watch snooker, which is like, because you can't quite summon the energy to change the channel or to get up. And then at the end of it, you're just like, this was fucking depressing.
Unfulfilled.
Yeah, this was fucking depressing. Like, this is the kind of thing that goes, I could have gone to the pub and watched this. And that applies in both situations. So actually, it's a fucking great analogy. All right, that brings this episode to a close. If you are a subscriber, you can catch us over on the paid side. If you're not a subscriber, please consider subscribing. Thank you to those of you who replied to my poll recently. Not very many of you, I must say. But I don't know. I've been thinking about this kind of stuff. Like, it would be nice if we could put the price down, but we don't want to like put the price down and just like basically make like half of the money, like, because we need the money to like run the podcast. But we've got a load of like consistent listeners, and it seems like a bunch of you show up every time. And to be honest, we would like all of you to listen to all the episodes. It's just that we have to have a Patreon, because otherwise this isn't workable now that we have three children between us. Anyway, spiel done. We will catch you later. Bye.